Hello, and welcome to Openly Gamer Theater's Tower of the Ape, a Savage Worlds Deluxe roleplay drama from the producers of Gamer's Table. Be warned, this production may contain some explicit material that may not be suitable for all audiences.
This is Dan. I'm going to be playing Matadai.
This is Shannon, and I'm playing Lovaisa.
Hi, this is Dave, and I'm playing Ronyos.
Hello, my name is Jason. I'm playing Odored Soractus.
And I'm Sean. I'm playing Mofir.
The sun reflected off the powdery white sand through the crystal clear water, causing the entire pool to shimmer with an eerie cerulean luminance as a lone craft deliberately oared its way deeper into the large karstic sea cave. It was a colossal cavern whose ceiling towered hundreds of feet above their heads, gradually tapering down until it abruptly ended in the steep face of a basalt bluff. Treacherously steep, natural stone steps lined the northern wall of the cave, originating from the cliffs outside and ending with a shelf 50 feet above the water. This natural walkway was barely wide enough for a man to tread, and so precarious in places that he would have to seek hand and footholds to get to sections of safer width. In the dim, flickering azure light of the glowing water, a structure built into the basalt wall of the immense cavern came into view. It was made of a weird marbled green stone and spanned the entire face of the far wall of the mammoth cave. Massive fluted colonnades rose from the depths, holding the graven entablatures with delicately intricate designs depicting strange bestial forms and shapes that were both geometric yet asymmetric. Both breathtakingly beautiful in its grandeur and nauseatingly disturbing in its unnaturalness, this cavern to forgotten gods loomed menacingly ahead of them. The passage of time causing the majority of the structure to submerge, sinking as if the sea and earth were consuming the tainted edifice in some terrestrial phagocytic response. Where architecture hadn't been swallowed by the sand, yet still underwater, thick, reddish-black moss grew like scabs formed over a festering wound. Astounded by the queer construction, Matadai crouched on the last step 10 feet above a platform that was supported by a row of green columns, whose capital and entablature were all that remained above the surface of the eerie, glowing water. Putting aside his unease at the structure, he turned his attention to the boat sluggishly gliding inside the wide rictus aperture. His heart sang at the sight of the woman steadily rowing the vessel. Leviisa oared with steady, stoic grace towards the slimy green stone platform, jutting above the calm, glowing water. She turned her attention to the stepped shelf and saw Manadai. A smile flashing on her lips, she quickened her effort. Though she acknowledged the bonded, she barely regarded the two men struggling to join him on his perch. Mofir, the strange Samorian mystic, supported the other man, Odred, who was quite obviously wounded by the contorted grimace on his face and the dried blood that caked his entire body. Halting to catch his breath, Odred looked at the passengers of the boat for the first time. The trip from the mainland to this island was a relatively simple affair, considering all the derelict vessels beached on the small bay. But his grievous wounds were taking a toll on his stamina.
By chance, did you bring a healer?
I recognize you, fellows. You look quite dead.
We don't have a healer, but we have provisions.
We have no healer, but would you like a sandwich?
None of you have any healing skills?
No.
We could cauterize a wound.
I think that might just make it worse.
We could set you on fire.
Odred, I wouldn't let any of them touch you.
Yes, stay clear of these.
You're right.
Ronyo scales the fluted pillar with supple grace, mooring line tucked in his crimson sash. Hanging by his hands from the cornice, he is forced to avert his gaze lest he stares directly at the blasphemous bas-relief image graven into the frieze. A powerful hand grasps his, and he is hoisted to the top of the entablature by the dark-eyed Hyrcanian bonded. The Zamorian thief nods at Matadai and thanks as he begins to tie the line to one of the smaller decorative columns as the rest of the boat's passengers clamber up the rope and his own companions toil down the steps. Matadai finally has the opportunity to inspect the shelf that he stands on. His head swims as he does so. Painfully familiar etched patterns are mixed with alien hieroglyphics and other queer images that make his skin crawl. Many of the images depict nightmare creatures and humans performing various acts of perverse depravity. Bile rises in his throat, then he feels a hand lightly rest on his shoulder.
Okay. This is too much.
It is nothing.
Something not right about this.
Mother tells
place.
Me that it's nothing.
Is anybody else looking at this wall and getting really sick?
Yes.
Stare at the ground.
There is nothing.
Ice blue eyes of the Aesir meet his as he is turned away from the vile etchings. She smiles, and they embrace. Her strength, her fierce vitality fortifies him, and his cold panic at seeing the profane ornamentation slowly subsides.
When we are out of this place, you have some explaining to do.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean.
Amid the strange construction, friends, old and new, greet each other with smiling nods and lighthearted pats to shoulders and backs. Not joining in the jubilation of the others, Valak looks suspiciously at the bonded and his friends. Unconsciously, his hand touches his shirt where his amulet rests.
No one said yet, but why are you three fellows here?
I don't know why you're here, but Mother told me to come.
And I'm with him.
And Mother will show the way.
Valak eyes them before finally turning his attention to the structure on which they all stood. His own senses and quick wit determined at a glance that the structure was largely ornamental. Immense columned arches of the building were cosmetic, and there was no opening to the interior structure. Remembering the way the edifice seemed sunken beneath the water and earth, Valak squinted his eyes in thought.
Maybe we can swim underneath.
As if the thought occurred to him moments before Valak voiced it, Odred adroitly springs off the ledge and into the glowing, cerulean water. As if he were laden with stones, the Pict sinks into the white sand and turns his head towards the moss-covered stone under where his companion stood. Raising one hand above his head, he then lowers it, indicating direction as he slowly strides.
Can't believe he actually did it.
Do I have enough air to go back?
Yeah.
Or should I just keep
it
going?
Actually, if it wasn't for the fact this platform that you're standing on was so long, you would have seen it perhaps when they were rowing up. But because it's so long and you just couldn't see it. But it's underneath, almost directly where they're standing.
I jump in after.
You get to him and you look over and he's pointing in a direction. You look over and you see that there is an arched doorway under the water.
See, they're pointing where we need to go.
Mofir starts swimming.
Crap.
Goes under where you guys are, and then you see Odred start to walk on the bottom of the water, you know, on the bottom of the sea there, and walking directly towards you and vanishes underneath where you are.
I guess we're all going in the water. Let's go.
I'll jump.
Shake my head and make for preservus. I'll jump in.
One by one, those around Matt and I begin jumping into the water and swimming under the looming stone shelf.
This is no place for a man of the desert. And I jump in.
Lobaisa watches Matt and I slowly submerge until his feet rest on the bottom. Perched on the edge of the platform, she smiles at the difficulty the usually self-sure, desert-bred man has with moving under the water. A billowing cloud of white sand swirls around him as he toils out of view. She leans forward and plunges in after him. The iron muscles of her back, shoulder, and arms ripple as they work in time with the rhythm of her legs.
She propels herself quickly past the bonded and Odorin, who apparently decided that he was better off without his cumbersome boiled leather jerkin and greaves, and therefore was in the process of stripping them off. She darts into the dark mouth of the foreboding archway, legs kicking smoothly in unison like the great rear flippers of a walrus. As imposing as the black of the sunken passageway was, it occurs to her she prefers blindness to seeing the nauseating architecture and artwork of this place. Were it not for her burning purpose, finding her father, and her hatred for Milos, the man who took him, she surely would have never ventured into a den of lunacy such as this. Aided by the tidal flow, steadily pressing from behind, and her Herculean reserves of stamina, she drove deeper and deeper into the ominous dark, heedless of the growing burn in her lungs. Suddenly, flat paving stones of a hallway meet her left hand on its downward stroke. Feeling the floor, she quickly realizes that the passage is gradually slanting upward. She presses on, and before long, a faint incandescence penetrates the murk from above. Her head surfaces into a large chamber covered, walls and floor, with coarse minerals bearing tufts of glowing golden moss which illuminate the room enough so that Lovaisa can see that the purpose of the pool she emerged from was a bath of some sort. At least, at one time it was. She crawls out of the water, crouches, scanning the room around her. Shadowed crevices in the walls play with proportion, making her uncertain as to the exact size of the room. The only other distinct feature, besides the strange natural bath, is a dark, high-arched doorway at the far end of the room, opposite the pool. Musky stench, borne on the barely perceptible breeze, emanates from the ominous portal. Lovaisa did not recognize the scent. It was malodorous and grim, causing the skin on her scalp to crawl. Faint splash from behind catches her attention. She turns to see Falak rise from the bath, sputtering with choked relief, lank hair plastered to his face like thin black fingers. Clearing away the locks, his queer eyes meet hers, eliciting a shudder from the Aesir. Something about being alone with this peculiar man, his eerie appearance, his decadent manner, made the barbarian adjust the grip on her axe. Heedless, he approached with a wide toothy grin.
Pop up. We're the only survivors. I try to give her a hug.
I just shove him.
You creepy man. Recoiling from her brutish rebuff, Valak frowns. His eyes flash with momentary ire until he notices some of the other companions slowly rising out of the water.
Oh, we're not the only survivors.
I immediately get down on my knees and start praying. Aldred, you have never looked better.
Yes, he's clean for the first time you've ever seen him.
I actually feel.
Who is this?
Fantastic.
Pick up Ronios, pat him on the back. All right, towards that entrance.
Ronios, you need to go through the door first.
I half draw my sword, and I tell you all, be quiet.
Great, I'm wet, half drowned, and surrounded by psychotics.
Yes.
We don't want him to know we're coming.
We're looking for Milos. He is here.
Peering into the deep darkness of the open archway, Mofir looks at Odred, then nods, all the while rubbing his ever-present smooth black river stone with his hairy knuckled hands. His slow caresses continues until the stone begins to glow with a faint blue haze. Meager light from the tufts of phosphorescent moss is supplanted by the more intensely glowing rock. Its bright azure lambency eerily gives everyone an unnatural cyanotic pallor. Unease from the strange glowing stone abated when the shadows of the hallway beyond the arched doorway melted.
I think maybe perhaps Mother has the right idea.
Lovaisa takes a step back from Ophir, eyes wide and hands clenching the haft of her axe. The steadying presence of the bonded beside her, her only reason for restraint, her instinct, was to destroy the perverse Zamorian conjurer where he stood.
I tolerated you last time, wizard. I suppose I can tolerate it again.
As I walk by Mofir, I wipe my hand on his face and get at some of his mud.
So you're just borrowing his mud?
Yeah. Make myself some war paint.
Okay. And it doesn't look like you even took a dent out of the mud that's on it.
You silly friend.
With Mofir holding the light source aloft, Odred slowly stalks ahead through the stone-lined archway and into the gloom of the rough-worked stone hallway. In the glow of the Zamorian's light, the graven images of grotesque bas-reliefs and weird hieroglyphics cause Odred and those behind him to groan with waves of nausea. At this close proximity, there was no way to avert their eyes to avoid seeing the unnatural images. Perhaps it was a play of the light on the carvings, or something altogether more sinister, which caused a distortion of perspective. Angles seemed to lack natural congruency, making Odred blink in confusion and reel with nausea. Faltering and stumbling, he couldn't clearly discern if he was walking on a flat surface or on a slope. Those behind him closed their eyes, lest they surrender to the maddening effect, placing their wavering hands on the shoulder of the person walking before them. Leading the way, attempting to focus on the lone archway at the far end of the passage, Odred grits his teeth in concentration. Eyes water as he fights the crippling sense of vertigo that the adorned hallway imposes upon him.
Nearly crumbling to the ground in relief, he and his companions finally emerge into a large, gloomy, dome chamber. The room is so vast that the glow of Mofir's rock did little to illuminate it, save the lapis lazuli floor and some titanic columns that stretch from floor to ceiling, bearing the same sickening markings as the dread hall they just departed. A vague shape towers amid the mammoth columns, indistinct in the gloom. A few steps closer, illuminated by the glowing stone, and then they stop, marveling at an immense, smooth green pyramid, seemingly carved from a single piece of jade, 100 feet to a side. A carved arched opening looms on the plain facing them. Cautiously creeping into the open, they stare mesmerized at the odd monument. Odred halts again. Shadowed motion at the edge of the light causes swift action from the pick, who wheels in place, hatchets at the ready. Trusting Odred's keen wilderness hoed senses, the others ready themselves without question. Shambling shapes silently lumber towards them from the shadows. Thick gray fur coats their vaguely anthropoid bodies. Taller than a man, they have thick hairy arms that hang nearly to the floor. Though they resemble the great gray brutes of the green ruins of the nearby mainland, they are markedly more human-like in build and manner. One beast, the largest of them by a considerable margin, bears a large crude stone shard with its massive hands. Dark stains coating its jagged edges, clear evidence of its deadly purpose.
More monkeys.
No, they're more man than ape.
I will not be the first one through the door of the pyramid.
I will take aim, okay. Which I get for free.
Who are you shooting?
The big.
You shooting at the big one?
Big,
okay.
Big dude. 11, so that's a raise.
Yes.
2 sixes. 26 plus 2 is 28 times 2.
Stone club of the massive creature drops to the floor as the beast grabs the arrow piercing its throat. With a gurgled wheeze, the monster falls to its knees, face contorted in rage and pain. Three of the hairy horrors step away from their dying chief and stare in awe of the small man who struck down their strongest from afar. The remaining five charge in on the gathered intruders. Two slavering creatures approach Ronios, intent on quickly overwhelming the Zamorian thief from two sides.
Oh, for the love of Bel!
The Vaisa stands before Madadai, attempting to ward off two of the brutes with a wave of her axe. One gets through her guard and manages to rake cracked nails across her shoulder, failing to break the tough hide of the Aesir. Phallic snarls as one barrels clumsily past him, his swift spin avoiding an attempt to grab him, and gives him an opportunity to draw his curved scimitar.
I'm going to go ahead and do a cold shot head.
She's trying to back him off.
Valak wildly swings at the nearest foe, only to find his opponents are much more nimble than their size would indicate.
By Mitra, these 8 men are going to kill us all and take Lovaisa alive. So I'm going to go after her, the one on her.
Oh, that's right, because she's the only very protecting of you.
5. Aww.
Thanks, buddy.
Parry of 5 is a hit.
11.
He is shaken, charging past Valakius. Rinyard's sword slices into one of the shaggy things assailing the Aesir. Though the hide of the creature is tough, the blade bites deep enough to draw its attention away from the girl and on to the Poitanian.
Well, I'm going to target the three of them with my jet.
Arcane roll.
8.
Okay, you got a raise, so you can either raise the damage or raise the whatever the extra effect is on that.
9.
Still stunned by the loss of their chieftain, three of the Dark Dwellers fail to see the wild-eyed man bound to them, dust beginning to churn in the air around him. When they do notice him, it is too late for them to react as grit swirls around them, shredding flesh from bone in a howl of deadly wind.
Thank you, Mother Earth.
Odred sees a neglected beast close silently on Madadai.
Charging, frenzy, two-fisted. 1, 7, and 4.
Okay, 7 hits. 3. The pick ferociously rushes in, hatches swinging in deadly arcs. He soon learns, as his companions have, that these monsters are unnaturally wily and able to avoid many of the attacks aimed at them.
Okay, so that's I got it. 2 on me?
Yes.
Damn. Okay, then I'm just going to stab at it.
Okay.
8.
8 explodes.
12.
Raise.
14.
By Bel!
Fat-bladed knife of the Zamorian flashes in the eerie light, piercing one of the hairy devils in the pit of his arm. With uncanny speed, the knife is twisted and withdrawn. The creature convulses as black blood darkens its fur and sprays from its mouth. Lucid, almost human eyes lock on the thief's. Long hands of the creature lightly caress Ronios' cheek as the blasphemous monstrosity sluggishly sinks to the floor.
So I'm going to try to intimidate. 6. 8.
He is shaken.
5.
5 is a hit.
4 or 2.
So no. Seeing the bestial rage in Lovaisa's eyes, her opponent steps back in confusion. In doing so, nearly has his skull split by the Aesir's axe.
I'm going to go to the one on Madadai. 2 attacks on that one.
On Madadai, okay.
10 explodes! 10 explodes! 24.
That's a raise. Only 1 hit?
Yeah, the other one was a 2. 25. I'm going with what Dan said.
Disregarding the monster nearest her, Lovaisa hews into the back of the one Odra drew away from Matadai. Hot blood sprays the bonded full in the face, who nods in appreciation to the woman.
Is there a penalty for shooting in combat?
Shooting into melee? If you roll a 1 on your attack die, you hit your friend.
Well, it's just Ronyos, right? So,
right.
So I will take a shot at
him. I hate you all.
That's a 12, so that's a raise. Okay. 23.
Seeing its mate fall, the remaining brood on Rodeos rears back in rage, intending to pummel the dark, slim man. Before it can bring its wrath to bear, a lone arrow strikes it, transfixing the misshapen skull from ear to ear.
Looks like one of those joke arrows.
Hey, he looks my way. I just give him the nod.
All right, so...
Thank you!
I hold up the sword of Durand and motion to the ape man. Come on! Come on!
You want this? You want this?
Try it!
I'll give you a free swing, ape man.
You have nobody.
There's nobody on you, but you can throw... The one on Rinyard is the last one.
I'm going to throw my magic dagger at him.
Throwing the magic dagger.
You might lose your magic dagger.
Yeah.
Could I lose the magic dagger?
Well, if you roll a 1, you hit Mike.
and then you lose the magic dagger.
6.
Hits, because you need a 4 when you throw.
So, 11.
Rinyard, meeting the eyes of the remaining monstrosity, smiles. For the first time since this short fight began, did one of the beasts show any sign of understanding. It knew death was near. As if suddenly realizing its dire situation, Rinyard's adversary turns to run. Before it could take 2 steps from the Poetanian, it collapsed in a heap, a Zamorian throwing dagger impaling the back of its head.
So these guys came from the surrounding darkness or from the pyramid itself?
From the surrounding darkness. Okay. You can see that there's like pools of even more inky blackness in the darkness.
There are you said there are pillars in here?
Pillars like, holding up the ceiling.
Are there any like braziers or torches or nothing? No.
Mofir's light source is still going.
Mother is showing us the way.
Odrin enters the inky blackness of the Jade Pyramid. He is relieved to note that the walls are devoid of queer etchings or nauseating patterns. Turning his head, the Pict urges the rest of his fellows to follow with a sidelong nod of his head. Going in, you see that the passageway is slate flags set into the floor. It is a rather wide passageway, so you could probably walk, 2 people side by side could walk through this if they wanted to, and it leads off into the darkness, and as you enter, you see that it goes for about 60 feet, and then you see an iron-bound wooden door.
Bet you wish we had a torch we could burn this door down with now, don't you?
I got a crowbar, we can pry it open.
Or that would work as well.
Thank you.
Odred and Mofir move to the wooden door as Ronios trails them, producing a slim pry bar from under his sash. The Master Thief smiles as Odred nods to him, impressed with the resourcefulness of the Zamorian.
Is there a lock on this door?
No. As a matter of fact, there's not even a handle on this door.
Oh.
Valak kneels down as he approaches the gathering at the door. Something about the slates catches his attention. His eyes dilate in understanding, and he opens his mouth. But before he can voice his concern, a cracking sounds beneath them. Ronios, Odred, Mofir, agility roll. As the flags crumble beneath your feet. Rinyard. Also make it.
What is our target number?
Those of you who are standing on the rotten flags, target number 6.
Am I standing on the
Rinyard,
flag?
Yes. Rinyard, you are at a straight up 4.
I'm right on the edge.
You're standing right. All right, so Rinyard, you're standing right on the edge. Before any at the door can react, the crumbling floor suddenly devours them. 1 second, they're inspecting the wooden door. The next, those remaining in the hallway are thrust into total darkness as Mofir's stone plummets with him.
No,
as the light goes down.
Bell's ball!
Sharp drop, 60 feet.
Oh, shit.
Jason's dead.
Into rushing water.
Oh. Still, but, hey, Jason, on the bright side, you could still drown.
Yes. That's a good point.
First thing I do is reach behind me and grab the lock by the shirt and back up.
Okay.
Hey, what happened?
The floor fell through, didn't you see?
We can't see anything. I'm sort of near the edge. I'm going to... creep up slowly.
Make an agility check as you creep up in the dark.
7.
You scramble backwards. From your vantage point, even looking down, you felt the hole and then it crumbled. You backed up out of it. There's no light. What you hear is rushing water.
There's no sign of them. The light is gone.
Well, we need some light. Dalak, now you want the torch?
I have the candle.
There you go.
Is there any way to get a footing to try to open the door and not fall down this
hole? Well, there's a 10-foot gap.
10-foot?
10-feet gap from the door itself to the last flag that's a little crumbly looking.
I'll pray.
Okay. Before you do what you're going to do, let someone else hold that candle.
I'll pass the candle over.
Okay. Thank you.
I shoulder my bow and I just pray. It's a leap of faith, right? I look over to Lovasa and I was like, see you on the other side.
The Aesir looks from Matadai to the door and then down into the dark, watery pit. She slowly nods in understanding, motioning for the bonded to step aside, allowing her more room.
I will try it.
You can do it.
If not,
I will find you.
What this amounts to is you're leaping.
Yes.
So what I'm going to say is you need to make a strength roll, target number 6. That will get you through the door and beyond so you don't bounce off and land in the pit.
Okay. 10.
All right, so what happens is Lovisa backs up and takes off running, springs off of Matadai, hits the door. It opens very easily.
Yeah. No.
And you tumble into the room, and the door closes.
Oh,
no.
Inside the room is inky blackness.
I'm going to open the door.
All right, so it closes behind her. Everybody kind of stands there for a second, and then it opens back up, and she's standing in the doorway.
Okay, so, well, I'll jump across, but I'm like, eh.
And so a successful strength roll is a DC 4.
Be ready to...
I was going to say,
You can try and grab them if they fail. If they fail, yes.
5.
Good.
Success.
7.
You're through.
Sploosh.
You got it. Oh. All right, so Renyard jumps through, and now you're through the door. Faint light from the flickering candle illuminates the bare stone circular room, whose only feature is a ring of etched stones circling a dark well. An overwhelming sense of doom washes over the gathered companions as a faint wind stirs in the room. Tingling of Renyard's scalp told him that whatever depths this well reached, it was very likely that it was not of this earth. Despite the Botanian's hissing protest, Valak steps towards the well, intent on deciphering the markings on the stones. Behind them, Matadai and Lovaisa inspect the wooden door they so easily burst through. Finding the reason for the door sealing of its own accord was not preternatural, but merely a stout spring bolted to the underside of the door, affixing it to the wall. Easily disabling the mechanism with a chop of Lovaisa's axe, they swing the door open fully.
12 on our knowledge arcana.
Just the arrangement of the stones, and as you start to look at this well, you realize that this well is actually emanating darkness.
Well, that's no good.
Everybody make a terror check. This is a sanity check, so it's a spirit check at a -2.
Spirit check -2.
Straight up! I got a 3.
Jam it.
3.
Cold darkness pulses out of the well, buffeting the companions with an imposing alien awareness of infinite age and depravity. The assault of consciousness is so abrupt and powerful, they can do little but stare in shock. All but Lovaisa. Instincts of the savage taking control, she springs out of the circular room, over the crumbled pit, and bounds down the slate-covered floor to the entrance of the pyramid, where she crouches in fear. Those of you who are standing in the room, including Matadai,
okay,
from inside the well, you hear a guttural voice.
Jump in.
Everybody in the room, make a spirit check.
I got a 10, and Dan's jumping in.
And what did... Valak gapes in horror as he watches Renyard move in a halting, jerking fashion towards the well. Like an automaton, he steps onto the stone lip and then folds forward, tumbling into darkness.
I follow Lovaisa out the door.
All right, make an agility check.
3.
In the dark of the jade hallway, Lovaisa crouches, attempting to gather her wits after feeling the dark consciousness of the well room and feeling its pull on her soul. A gleam of light catches her eye and she sees the form of Valak rushing towards her and then abruptly disappear, plummeting into the pit of the rushing water that the rest of their companions fell into minutes ago. In his disorientation, he dropped the lone candle on the slate floor just inside the now open doorway. With the strange man out of the way, she sees into the nightmare room, her breath catching in her throat. Matadai moved in a bizarre fashion, as if he were fighting against his own body. The sight of her friend struggling sickened her and spurred her into furious action.
I'm gonna go back. I'm gonna face my fears. I'm gonna go back into that room and try to get my friend.
Jumping up, she rushes down the hallway with increasing speed, springs over the crumbled slates and the watery pit. Entering the circular room with the dark well, she cries out in frustration. Time slows as she sees Matadai look helplessly at her, then fall into darkness. Without hesitation, she dives in after him. Falling into utter blackness and into black icy water, Odred struggles to get his bearing while the rushing current holds him and whirls him with breathless speed. Every attempt to fight the force sweeping him through the lightless nightmare failed. Brief pockets of air enabled him to quench the burning of his lungs, but rare respites were fleeting.
The black water churned and frothed around him with such frenzy that he was soon swept up anew. He was keenly aware that should he release his grip on his treasured hatchets, it was likely he would never see them again. Occupied with his ordeal, he doesn't register the glowing light ahead of him until it is already too late. Air, open air, greets him as he is thrust into the open. The water falls beneath him into the pool of an underground grotto. He is momentarily weightless, and then he plunges into glowing green water. Thrown clear of the thundering roil of the waterfall, he easily surfaces and gapes at the steady cascade of dark water flowing into the large grotto from a cleft in the cave wall. The water he was treading, aglow with a ghostly green luminance, unnerved Odorid. He had never experienced anything like it, and savage superstitions danced in his head. In addition to the unnatural light it cast, there was a harshness to it that gagged him and stung his eyes. A large, square object.
Dibs.
That rises from the from under the water all the way in through the ceiling, busting through the ceiling. It looks like some sort of internal structure.
Huh.
Completely crafted inside this underground glowing grotto.
I'm going for the structure.
The pick strips his clothing, now shredded rags, and swims for the wet black structure, noting the dark shapes forcefully expelled from the rent in the cave wall and plunging into the glowing water beside him. Paying little heed to his comrade's arrival, he reaches the bizarre structure in a few swift strokes. Slight ridge just under the waterline allows him to rest and focus on his surroundings with interest. Feeling the alien texture of the structure with his hands, he cannot place its nature. A strange mineral substance coats it, making it slightly coarse. Scraping the coating with his thumbnail, without effect, he considers using one of his axe blades to mar the surface, but then thinks better of it. Watching Ronios and Mofir paddle towards him, he sees another dark shape plunge in behind them. Valak abruptly surfaces, sputtering in the acrid water. Odorid looks down as Mofir nears him and notices for the first time an odd shape directly below him. Moving to the side to get a better view, he realizes that it is a large wheel, a giant hatch wheel, set into the side of the structure. You guys can make your way out of the water.
I will hang my axes around my head, and I'll start turning the wheel.
You have to go under the water to turn the wheel.
Oh, am I going to hold my axes naked?
You're going to have somebody hold your axes for you.
Hold these, Mofir.
Odorid nods to his friend, handing him his beloved weapons, and drops below the water. Gripping the large metal wheel, he braces his feet against the structure for leverage. Burning in his eyes starts anew in the noxious water. First roll, hold your breath. Second roll, withstand the poison. Third roll your strength.
Hold my breath.
Okay.
Got it. And poison? Got it.
Roll your strength.
Five.
All right, you get down there, and it doesn't budge. The rest of you see Odorid go underwater, and he's tugging at this large metal wheel.
Go help him.
You go help him.
I'm not that strong.
What do I look like?
Get your mother to help him.
Yeah, what happened to Mother Earth?
All right, hold the axe.
All right.
You go down with him?
I called dibs on this axe. He don't come back.
Valak watches Odorid and Mofir struggle with the wheel below him for a moment before his eyes turn towards the dark cave walls of the grotto. Shadowed movement in the gloom catches his attention. His eyes turn to Ronios, standing on the ledge beside him, idly inspecting the craftsmanship of Odorid's axes. The Zamorian thief, feeling eyes on him, looks at the strange man. Valak motions for Ronios to follow, and then drops below the water himself. Frowning, the Zamorian thief shakes his head. He had no intention of going below and wrestling with some rusted wheel that likely has years of corrosion cementing it in place. Once the fools realized that their actions were folly, they would come up and they could look for a way out of this horrendous place. A strange groaning sounds from below him, and a swirling in the water catches his attention. He glimpses Valak, frantically grasping at the edge of a perfectly circular hole in the structure. The strange man reaches up and grasps Ronios' leg in panic, raising his free foot, intending to kick Valak off of him. The Zamorian loses his grip on the slick handhold and plunges into the water and is drawn into the hellish black structure. Blackness envelops you in its cold embrace, and your soul floats naked in cosmic oblivion. Deafened and blinded by absolute dark, you feel the presence of consciousness, ancient and demented. It comes so close as to almost touch you, but then recoils in some warped act of prolonging exquisite anticipation. Your consciousness thins as you are spread out, unraveled, inducing existences previously forgotten. Awareness assails you as you look upon memories trapped in race and ancestry. Bare feet fleeing a burning village and the stroke of a conqueror's sword. Strips of your back flayed off from the bite of the lash. the feel of rough hands on your flesh, dragging you down in brutal lust, intense hatred, and helplessness as you watch your wide-eyed child die of starvation while you sit in the glow of a food-filled shop window. Burning sands clogging your nose, mouth, and tear-filled eyes as you await death. Sensation compounds on sensation until you no longer can discern one life from another. Until finally, darkness falls again and you are bathed in tranquil oblivion. Pain lances through your eyes as the searing light of a flaring sun burns hotly on your face. As your eyes adjust, you realize that it is not the burning sun, but the flickering of a lone candle in a tall, filigreed holder. You lie on a soft, red velvet carpet that partially covers the polished stone floor of a great hall. It is difficult to determine exactly how big the hall is due to the limited illumination, but if the echo of your breathing is any indication, it must be enormous. Looming directly before you is an idol of grotesque proportions, sitting on a tall-backed throne graven in the image of a coiled snake. The black iron idol resembles the hairy gray beasts you've encountered before. Same bullet head, close-set eyes, flaring nostrils. The marked difference being that the gigantic simian modeled here is completely hairless. The thickly muscled broad body and stubby, bowed legs recline on the coiled body of a giant snake that forms the chair that the statue rests on. Smooth, carved scales glisten iridescently in the candlelight. The broad left hand of the statue rests thickly jointed fingers on the sculpted head of the great serpent, its thumb inches away from a gaping eye socket.
Gaping eye socket? Like there's something that should be there?
Exactly.
Like a giant gem?
Could be.
The sound of a sword being drawn attracts Lovaeus' attention. Grim-faced, Brynjard stands, feet widely braced. The light of the lone candle dances along the blue steel blade in his broad hands as he slowly turns to assess the nature of their surroundings. Beside her, Madadai lies, covering his eyes with his hands, moaning. She looks at her confidant. The flickering light plays with her senses as he appears aged, as if years had gone by in the last few moments. She kneels beside him, helping him to his feet, then suddenly recoils. What she mistook for an illusion of the dim light was actually real and disturbing. A shock of Madadai's hair had gone bone white. That, coupled with the haunted look of the bonded's eyes, told her that her friend was on the brink of madness. Without thought, she rears back a brawny hand and slaps the Hyrcanian full in the face. His eyes widen in shock, then clear lucidity stares back at her.
Do my best to, like, regain my faculties here, because this has been a really bad day.
Yes, it has.
It's like one horrific thing right after another. So I'm going to pray for a little while.
Madadai shifts to his knees and places his forehead to the rich velvet carpet, praying. The Aesir rises and steps beside Brynjard. The Poetanian remained on his guard, though there was no immediate threats. She places a hand on his shoulder, and he looks at her with smoldering intensity.
Mumbling, looking around to the vast hall.
The illumination of the candle is not reflecting off of anything. It goes, you know, about 15 feet out, and then darkness.
But I will, do not move from the spot.
I'm going to take one of my arrows, and I'll rip off, like, a sleeve, and I'll try to make a bit of a torch, and I'll go light it on the candle, so maybe we can get a little bit more light.
Holding the makeshift torch high, Madadai steps beside the grotesque black statue, sitting on the coiled white marble serpent. His eyes linger on the gigantic likeness and shudders, remembering the shambling monstrosities that he, Odrin, and Mofir encountered in the ruins. This statue was so akin to the gray apes they fought, though hairless, and reminded him of idols in temples to the south, where they revere a grim monkey god and sacrifice screaming girls in its name. He turns and looks up to the dome ceiling before settling on the nearest arched doorway, then slowly starts walking towards it. As he nears, he abruptly halts. The faint sound of breathing in the dark chamber beyond causes the hair on the back of his neck to stand. With cautious grace, he pulls an arrow from his quiver and knocks it on his bow. Lovaisa, seeing Madadai's guarded demeanor, closes the distance to stand beside him, her hands held high, head of her axe poised over her shoulder. A croaking voice sounds from the dark that causes cold shivers to crawl down her back.
Ymir.
Oh no.
wet and cold robes weighed heavily on him, making it hard for him to breathe, and the simple act of turning on his side was torturous. Mofir struggled with his waterlogged restraints until he freed first one, then the other arm, leaving them naked. Cold air circulating around him was stale and musty. Propping himself up on his elbow, he surveyed his surroundings through his lank hair. The strange circular room was bathed in a queer red light, emanating from glowing crystals set in equal intervals in the walls. Stirring where they lay sprawled around him, his companions looked about in addled confusion, except for Odred, who squatted beside him in his peculiar flat-footed fashion. The Pict was fully alert, head swiveling as he gripped his axes tightly, eyes black pools of smoldering hate. Four round metal doors, all except the closest, were closed, the open portal revealing a large chamber beyond. Fat petals of immense flowers hang from thick stems and sprout from twisting creepers. The eerie crimson glow emanates from the walls of this chamber as well, masking the hue of the blossoms. Partially obscured by the growth, a black dais occupies the center of the room, topped by an intricately engraved stone sarcophagus. Mofir didn't remember standing up, yet he was on his feet, eyes locked on the dais and its occupant. He takes a step toward the open doorway and then halts. Tears begin streaming down his face as he turns to Odred. The Pict's eyes narrow, and then he nods and smiles.
We're seriously going to follow the crazy man.
Go to smell the air in that doorway.
I've been following him this whole time. Why are you with us?
There's a very sweet
smell. I fell in the hole.
And I'll check that against the other three doors.
None of the others smell as sweet. Crossing the threshold of the chamber is like passing through a cloying membrane of scent. What at first seems a sweet melange of fragrance quickly becomes something more unsettling the further they progress. The oversaturated saccharine air is difficult to breathe deeply without inducing waves of lightheadedness and nausea. Colossal petals droop to the floor, bobbing as if stirred by a gentle breeze. Flowered vines carpet the floor, protruding from cracks through the rough stone to intermix with their stemmed cousins, overgrowing the stone planters along the walls. Dominating the center of the room is the vine-covered, black and brown stone sarcophagus. As they close on it, the graven visage of the cover comes fully into view. It is that of a regal, dark-skinned woman with a golden headdress. The sight is as if an artist rendered a beautiful queen that fell asleep amid a garden of flowers.
Though you're not very knowledgeable about the nature of it all and how it could be possibly done, you do know that each one of these flowers is a lotus flower.
Yep.
And you know, just from knowledge arcane, that the black lotus, if consumed correctly, could revitalize magical power. So in game terms, completely revive all your spell points.
Start smoking, boys.
But the problem is, the red light in this room makes it hard to discern which ones are black, which ones are other colors. There's obviously some that are more pale than others, but some are black. You're not sure what the other colors are.
Cast light.
Ronios, pick some of those flowers for me.
I don't think so. Second you want me to pick flowers, the second I know it's all wrong.
The rock in the mystic's hand flares with bright blue light, causing the overgrown room to become clear and vibrant. Black blossoms hang from stems and are interspersed with other lotus of purple, gray, and golden yellow. Such efflorescence, mixed with the green of the vines, leaves, and fronds, evokes such an inner peace within Mofir that he drops to his knees in ecstasy. A disembodied voice resonates within the room.
I knew that you would come, my love.
What the bell was that?
Does the voice sound familiar? Or?
Yes, to you and of obviously Mofir. It's the voice of the lady that you spoke to when you first... Mother.
All right, folks, I think it's time we get the bell out of here.
I'm going to the sarcophagus.
Same.
I'll keep my eye on Odored over there while he's messing with the sarcophagus, just to see if anything interesting happens.
I'm going to hang back near the door and just sort of watch everybody.
This sarcophagus is made of stone, and the female form on the top of the sarcophagus is a perfect likeness of the brown-skinned woman that you saw before. With one exception, she's wearing a golden headdress.
He must be stopped. The old one must be awoken from its slumber. Darkness grows.
Who in the name of Bell are we talking to?
It's the Earth Mother. It's
Mofir's mother.
Why is she in the bottom of a cave?
I don't know.
Oh,
as good a place as any for the Mother of the Earth.
Earth Mothers are not my purview. You want to talk about serpents?
No,
I'm your fella.
That's fine. That's fine. Who has awoken the darkness?
There is no answer to your questions.
Oh, great.
You have come. My champions.
I'm going to climb up on the sarcophagus.
Okay.
Get off of it.
He must be awoken from his nightmare. Complete his task.
Must be awoken?
The dreamer is the answer. or all is lost.
Okay, where do we go?
He is blind. Only with the eye can the way be seen.
Is that that? Don't. Who's got the big, great big gem?
Nobody. Certainly not me.
You have the eye.
He
on
lies.
You.
He's got it.
What's up, Ronios?
I know mine. You've got it.
It's my damned eye.
You must return it.
It was mine to begin with.
Lift this lid so that I may see you, my champions.
I grab the lid and start trying to rip it off.
Yeah, I haul balls down the hallway.
Oh, mother.
You just start running?
Yeah.
He runs away.
I mean, like, savagely trying to get the lid off.
All right, it doesn't resist. It's made of stone, so just a successful strength roll.
She said open the sarcophagus. I'm opening the sarcophagus. And I'm going to hump her desiccated corpse.
Wow.
God.
Veins on the pick's neck stand out as he tediously wrenches the stone cover from the sarcophagus. Inside is the shriveled mummy of a partially simian child.
Oh, no. Not gonna hump that.
And it's wearing a necklace with thick golden wedges, and it has red stones set into each one of the wedges and queer writing on it that you've never, of a language you've never seen. Once the sarcophagus lid is opened, the voice says,
"Kiss me, Mophia, my love. Open yourself to me. Allow me inside you."
That's it, I'm out.
Come on, Mophia, we've come this far. Come on.
Mother, I did not expect this.
I will share with you the secrets that I bear.
I kiss the mummy.
Consciousness of the Earth Mother now enters you fully, and the mummy crumbles into dust. Mophir's knees buckle as if he were burdened with a sudden heavy weight. Then he slumps to the vine-covered floor, writhing in spasmodic ecstasy. The power released from this transferal, everyone gets visions in this room.
What do we see?
A wedge of blackness floating in cosmic darkness, black on black. The tower streak from the sky and plummet to the earth. Beings inside the tower slowly coming out.
One by one, my brothers left us. They took with them the stones of power, and where they trod, they were worshipped as gods.
A wave of profound sorrow washes over the gathered men.
You now stand in the chamber of the lost, our prison of flesh and soul, our penance for betraying the dreamer.
We have to find this dreamer.
Let's go.
Me and Mother have taken a journey that I did not expect.
Only the last remains. He must be freed, for only he can wake the dreamer. Only the dreamer can deliver us. You must do this to save your world. Hurry, my love. He is here. He awaits you.
Sounds like we're going to have to explore all these.
All right, well, I'm saying we stick together, because if we split up, there's bad things going
to
happen.
Yeah, we need to stay strong.
Yes.
Let's just start at the right.
Okay. First one on the right? Sounds good to me.
As the round metal door swings inward, Mophir's eyes dilate in delight. He and Ronyo stand transfixed, fascinated at the contents of the large round chamber. Treasure was heaped, lining the floor and adorning the walls. Frosty jewels twinkle from their settings, dazzling their eyes. Diamonds, rubies, emeralds, sapphires, all winked in the glow of Mophir's lighted stone, frozen like a starfield. Along the far wall stands massive clay urns, some with great stoppers carved from ivory, others open and overflowing with fine golden dust, swirling like tiny drifts of glittering snow. Squat stacks of silver and gold ingots lie to the right of the door, where the pair of Zamorians stand, each bar stamped on the side with strange hieroglyphics, which seem to glow and shift in the cold, weird light. Gem-crusted weapons and armor of steel and bronze rest on displays of polished carved wood and etched precious metals. Each set a work of a master artisan, beautiful melding of art and war. In the center of the room, three tall ivory pedestals stand like honored sentinels amid the great trove of riches. Black velvet pillows rest atop each, dented with imprints of burdens they no longer bear.
I want to load my pockets with gems.
I will put on a suit of the baddest-ass armor I can find.
You start putting on plate armor and it doesn't fit. It's made for someone or something probably twice your size.
Damn.
And without your proportions. The chain, you could probably wear. It would be a little long for you, but you could probably belt it.
Okay. Is there just a straight-up change of clothes in here?
No, there's no real like clothing, no.
What about a staff?
There's a gold and iron staff.
I'll just empty my marbles into a bowl and fill that up, the marble bag with jewels.
I think we're kind of getting distracted here. We need to move on.
You step into the next room. And it's a circular room, much like the other two. There is an eerie red glow emanating from the walls of this room as well. The treasure room was dark, so you guys provided your own light. This one has the eerie red glow, just like the Lotus room. There is a mammoth glass case filled with a yellowish fluid and a writhing tentacled horror.
Valak steps forward, eyes wide with fascination as the others shrink back in revulsion. The semi-translucent form in the enormous crystalline encasement rhythmically undulates as if stirred by some current, though the liquid that houses the thing does not ripple. He closes on the horrible thing, placing his hands on the cool, clear structure housing it. A segmented gray and blue tentacle slaps where his hands rest, pink feelers adhering to the crystal. He leans his face closer, his amused grin frozen, eyes widened in horror. What he mistook for feelers were actually tiny maws, pink puckered lips over fine pointed teeth, much like those he had seen in Kush, in the mouths of vicious flesh-eating fish. Valak, his back to his terrified companions, smiles, eyes glinting with recognition.
What in the name of Holy Bell is that?
Mother Earth, what is this?
A spawn of Thog.
Do not go near this thing. It is a child of Thog.
Preserved in Zuthal's own ichor.
Does anyone know of an ichor of Zuthal?
Oh yes, I have some here. No, I don't know what that is.
There is a table next to this case, and on this table are several sealed crystal jars with golden fluid inside. It looks like the same kind of fluid that this thing is floating in.
Partake of the ichor, my love, for it is the succor you require. Curative. It will aid you and your companions.
My companions?
Me, I'm hurt really bad.
All right. This fluid will come in handy. We do need to bring this.
Yeah. So how many jars do you grab?
All of them.
There's like 30 of them.
Five of them.
Just each grab one.
We each grab two.
Okay.
I'll drink it.
You open up the crystalline top and you get this putrid stench.
Thog spew.
You drink it and it's mostly liquid. Some of it's a little clotted.
It's awesome. I swallow it. I don't even chew.
I love a crunchy beverage.
It's like swallowing oysters.
Like eating an egg.
You're totally healed.
Wow.
Okay, wait. Can I drink some of that and get rid of one of my wound?
You see him drink it and you see his wounds start to knit.
I'm drinking.
Watching the grievous wounds on Modred's racked body neatly knit, Mofir smiles. He raises the fetid jar, bearing the clotted ichor to his lips. Thousands of icy fingers crawled over him, eliciting an orgastic quiver. Opening eyes he did not remember closing, he idly watches his companions exiting and trying the door to the last chamber of the lost. In this room, you see there is a large throne of iron. Sitting on this throne is a misshapen, pallid figure, very emaciated, with elongated arms, simian in appearance, short, stubby legs, barrel chest. And it's sitting there, and its eyes are glazed in madness.
It's alive?
And it's taking shallow breaths.
Oh, shit.
Next to it, you see what can only be determined as a war totem, in that it is a silvered mail armor, golden greaves, and a bull ape-shaped masked helm. Sitting next to it is an oversized, unearthly, silver-studded metal club. And it is humongous.
I take it the armor and the club would be way too big for me.
Yes.
Damn it.
It looked like it might fit this creature sitting on this chair, though.
Maybe my brother.
How big is this creature?
It's twice the size of a man.
Damn.
Okay.
On this armor is a golden belt and a sheathed dirk. The belt is made of linked golden wedges, much like Mofir's necklace.
I'm going to take the belt and the dirk.
Can I use my stealth to sneak behind it?
Its eyes don't even look at you as you walk in. Its head tilts.
Is that you again, Yakin? Have you not taken enough from me?
No.
You have taken all my dear children, claimed them as your own. Still, I will never tell you where she is. No matter the dollar you bestow on me, she is safe, and the shards with her.
And then he kind of gibbers.
Is this a sleeper that must awaken?
Madness, Zuthal! Madness! Yakta Zuthala! It is madness!
Particularly lively now that we've started speaking.
Joined the stone again.
The disembodied voice of Mother Earth resonates amid the companions as if emanating from the very walls.
Poor Gola. He is tormented so.
Poor Gulla?
Gulla is the name of the Pictish ape war god of the moon.
I'm going to walk up to him.
He's just sitting there, and like I said, he's just pale and emaciated. His lips are all flabby, and he's drooling. Okay, doesn't seem to see you.
I'll bow in supplication and kiss his feet.
His toes wiggle because he's got hand-shaped feet.
Awesome.
A lot of monkey kissing going on here.
He is the last of us. He must be freed, restored.
How do we restore him?
He is trapped in this mortal realm, as I was, as is the dreamer. He bears no bond to this place, as I have with you, my love. He must be released from this terrible oblate of weak flesh and immured soul.
Great pitiful sadness washes over Mophir, as if realizing the decrepitness of a once powerful, mythic figure, seeing this through the eyes of a loving child.
He was the bravest of us. To be thus dishonors him.
I'm going to start putting his armor on him, chanting a war song as I...
You're donning this armor for him? Okay. He doesn't seem, and he doesn't seem to resist in the least, and the armor is, if not a little big on him, because he's emaciated. It looks like he's been drained. It definitely should fit him.
The stunned gathering watches as Odoret reverently clothes the wretched beast in the ornamented battle cures, each movement lovingly venerated and gentle. Finally, the pick lifts the great bull ape masked helm and slowly places it on the pitiful creature's head. His task complete, he turns to his friends, eyes slick with tears.
How would I go about restoring him, Mother?
I say we kill it.
Release him, my love. Release him from his torment.
Odred draws a crystal-bladed dirk from the segmented belt, turns the handle away from himself, and lightly places it in Mophir's hand. Mophir stares at the weapon, stunned. He looks at Odred questioningly, but all the pick can do is shake his head. Cold realization washed over Mophir. As hardened a man as Odred was, Gulla was still a revered god amongst his people. Savage superstition prevented him from completing the gruesome task. The red light of the chamber glowing queerly on the clear crystalline blade, Mophir inspects the weapon, marveling in its dangerous beauty as he turns it in his hand.
Do it, my love. Free my father from this hell. Restore his ruined honor.
Mophir steps forward, looking deeply into the glazed eyes of the mad ape god, places the needle-pointed dagger under its chin, and thrusts with all his might.
You see that the clouds that were covering his whitened eyes start to dissipate, and then his eyes look at you in perfect sanity.
Gulla?
Burst of unseen primal energy erupts from the beast, flattening those gathered around it, washing over them with alien intensity. A rumbling tremor shakes the structure as a phantasmal emanation rushes up from the dead ape and surges out into the round antechamber. The glowing spectral force rises and bursts a portal above their heads, one that the group previously failed to notice. Astonished, the comrades scramble to their feet.
Follow that ape!
How high up is it?
It's like 10 feet.
Follow.
Bearded face of Manadai squints toward the inky blackness of the open doorway. He knew what the voice beyond it meant. The bonded turns toward Lovaisa, a slight smile touching his lips.
Lovaisa, I suspect your father is over here. Come quickly.
Where? And I dash.
Foolish girl, where are you going?
I blunder.
I chase after her,
getting ready for covering fire.
I'm drawing my axe.
You draw your axe?
I'm running with an axe.
All right, in this room, you see two men chained to a wall. One is rather scrawny, and the other one is a large Aesir man.
Okay.
Both look as if they have been mostly starved. When I say chained to the wall, I mean they have a brace around their body, chaining them to the wall, and then cuffs on their feet and wrists, chaining them to the wall, to a large ring set into the wall.
Is it my...
It's
father?
Your father.
It
yes.
is my father.
Yes. Emeld.
And who is...
Just double checking.
Who is the other?
Someone you do not recognize.
Someone I've never seen before.
Father, I found you, finally. I start trying to work at the...
All right, so he looks up in shock. His lips are parched as if he probably hasn't had anything to drink in a while.
Because I'm a traveler. I have
rations with me, and then I also have my flask and a canteen.
Do you have any food? I left all our rations in the boat.
I break off.
And so you put your sack down and you start going through it to get your rations. You're giving him water.
I'll tend to the other one.
Okay.
She's taking care of her father.
Rainyard, what are you doing?
Keeping an eye on around the rest of the room.
Okay. Are you in this room or are you in the big room?
Oh, I followed after him.
Okay. In the doorway or where are you?
Doorway.
Dark eyes widen with fear, then soften as the chained man looks at Matadai. He mumbles in a tongue that is foreign to the bonded. Then seeing the Hyrcanian's confusion, his cracked lips part in what may be a smile.
Oh, to have come so far and fail. Leave me. I am deserving of my fate.
Despite his words, he drinks greedily from Matadai's proffered flask, nuzzling against the bonded's hands when the vessel is withdrawn.
Though I thank you, my friend. Alas, unless you bear the keys to our shackles, a mailed and woeful aura are doomed.
Who has kept you here?
Lips of the haggard man writhe as the name oozes from him.
Milos.
Milos?
He is a wicked knave. He gained my trust. He stole the shard from me.
The shard? What shard?
I was blinded by my own ambition, trusting of those who have no honor. His degenerate companion laid an ambush. They stripped it from me, my greatest treasure, after I had unlocked its secrets.
His head rolls back in anguish.
Oh, merciful Ishtar, why am I stricken so?
Well, we're going to get you out of here.
He nods. The reddened eyes of Aura meet matted eyes.
I only wish to draw upon some of the power of the tower. Milk its secrets. Milos, he seeks to rouse him. Wake the sleeping god.
That sounds like a terrible idea, but we shall see.
Imeld is hugging you and he says,
It warms me to see you, but how did you get here?
I've been traveling far and wide for years looking for you, and finally I found you. I'm so happy I found you.
But you should not have come to this place.
I'm saving you. We're going back home.
I will not have you pay the debt my sins has brought upon me, my daughter.
What are you talking about, father?
In my youth, I made a terrible mistake. A mistake I hid from, and am now paying the price.
His ice blue eyes well with tears.
You must go, now. Leave this place.
I'm not leaving without you. And then I'm going to try starting on the lock now. I'm going to try and use brute force, see if I can do anything.
I don't
like
the tone of that conversation.
From the large room, you hear a voice.
Sword half drawn.
Sword half drawn. A familiar voice echoes from the vast chamber.
Try as you might, my northern beauty.
What language?
Nordheimer.
You will never free Imeld. His binds are more than physical. His soul will burn for his transgression. And the last sight he sees will be that of his own daughter's stripped flesh draped across the altar of Hanuman.
The immense room suddenly brightens with hundreds of glowing white crystals set into the walls and atop titanic marble pillars. Milos smiles broadly, his dark hair glistening like jet, his black eyes, like smoldering chips of obsidian, narrow in smug amusement. Stepping from the shadows created by the base of one of the mammoth pillars, a man of eerily androgynous beauty glides next to Milos. His chiseled face cracks with a toothy grin as his golden-colored eyes meet matted eyes. Kai Sharan, the agent of King Yezdegerd, the man who betrayed the bonded, silently watched him as one of his hands slowly caressed Milos' arm. Arrayed around the two smug villains were a score of naked, red-eyed, and slavering mindless. Horrible monstrosities were in the room also. Each all too familiar to Matadai. Shaggy hulks of the near men, Neanderthal brutes, hunched in a cluster near the closest pillar, and a handful of giant gray-furred bullet-head apes stalked from a far pillar.
At my best, I could only take 20.
I'm rushing Milos. As soon as I see him, I rush him.
Grab her before she get through the door.
I'm gonna kill him!
You go out there. It's suicide.
Let them come to us.
I sigh and I wait.
In his hand, he holds a glowing green stone.
The shard. It grows powerful as its mate nears. They call to each other to be whole again.
His smile broadens.
You have brought it to me, my treasure. I will gain everything. And you.
Face frozen in his predatory grin, his eyes glisten with triumph.
You have failed.
I start struggling again. I'm itching to fight.
All right, I'll start it off. I'll knock an arrow, draw it, like I'm going to shoot it at Milos.
Mm-hmm.
Then right before I fire, I go over to Kai Sharan and let it go.
Steady rumbling, like an approaching avalanche, shakes the room. Matadai watches the missile release, and time slows.
He sees the falcon-feathered fletching turn slowly as the arrow sails gracefully toward Kai Sharan. Then the far door buckles inward and then shatters with a concussive boom. A spectral emanation flows into the vast chamber, swirling about the white serpent throne. Rising up, it slowly engulfs the gargantuan ebon statue, creaking like that of frozen hinges coming to life, sounds as the seated black figure arches its back as if in terrible agony. It opens its mouth and screams.
Hanuman!
Thank you for listening. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of Tower of the Ape. Please check for further episodes on our website, gamerstable.com. Any use of this production for commercial purposes is prohibited. Written credit for music and other properties used in this production can be found on this episode's dedicated webpage. Conan is the property of Conan Properties International, who have graciously allowed us to make this production. Savage Worlds Deluxe is the property of Pinnacle Entertainment Group. Openly Gamer Theater and Gamers Table are trademark properties of Side Tangent Productions.